You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And the Library Foundation is instrumentally involved in supporting programs at the Los Angeles Public Library, from hotspots to tests to homework help, college prep to adult literacy. The list is long and the programs are vital in giving access and help to Angelenos across this vast city. This season, we're focusing on resilience. We picked this idea for many reasons. Most importantly, it spoke to now and how all of us in our own way have had resilience in the face of a different world we've been living in for the last 20 months. We've altered our lives again and again. Oh, did everyone hear me? I guess not. Maybe I should start again. Anyway, let me begin. I think we might have had a bit of a snafu. So I'm Jessica Strand. I'll make everything brief. The director of the public programs at the Los Angeles Public Library. And I will be introducing tonight Ruth Ozeki. So let me just go and introduce her and the novel, since I think there might have been a problem. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have the wonderful writer Ruth Ozeki with us, discussing her new novel with short story writer Amy Bender. Ozeki's novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness, gives power to libraries and books as a place of salvation. There, her protagonist can find strength to endure his painful world. The novel follows Benny, a teenager who hears voices after his father dies. First, he hears his father, then the emotions of objects, a pair of scissors, a table leg, a sneaker, then a book. The book not only talks, but talks back to Benny and assists him in narrating this coming of age tale. The question of what is normal, how do we deal with grief and grieving, how do we relate to the objects around us, all of this is looked at from various angles with tenderness, humor, and acute awareness of the endless continuum which we all inhabit. Benny finds refuge from himself in a public library where objects only whisper. The book, the public library, need I say any more? Introduction should never give a book away, but only give the smallest morsel to tempt an audience to want more. Ruth Ozeki is a novelist, filmmaker, and a Zen Buddhist priest. She is an award-winning author of four novels, My Year of Meats, All Over Creation, and A Tale for the Time Being, which was a finalist for the 2013 Booker Prize and has been translated into 28 languages. And most recently, The Book of Form and Emptiness. Her nonfiction work includes a memoir, The Face, A Time Code, and the documentary film Halving the Bones. She is affiliated with the Everyday Zen Foundation and lives in Western Massachusetts, where she teaches creative writing at Smith College and is a Grace Jarko Ross 1933 Professor of Humanities. She'll be talking tonight with Amy Bender, who is an award-winning author of six books, including most recently The Butterfly Lampshade. Her work has been translated into 16 languages. Her short fiction has been published in Granta, GQ, Harper's, Tin House, McSweeney's, The Paris Review, and more, as well as heard on PRI's This American Life and Selected Shorts. She lives in Los Angeles with her family and is a professor of creative writing at USC. Please welcome Ruth Ozeki and Amy Bender. Thank you very much for being here this evening.
There we go.
Excellent.
Hi. Thank you so much, Jessica. That was a beautiful introduction of the book. I really appreciate that.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm really glad to see you both. Let me let you talk.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Jessica. And I'm going to let Ruth begin the program by, she's going to start us out by reading a bit from the book, and then we will launch into questions.
Great. Great. Thanks so much, Amy. Okay. Yeah, I thought I would just, you know, since this is a book about voices, I thought I would start by just reading a tiny little bit to give you a sense of the voices that I heard as I was writing the book. So I think I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning. Okay. In the beginning. A book must start somewhere. One brave letter must volunteer to go first, laying itself on the line in an act of faith from which a word takes heart and follows, drawing a sentence into its wake. From there, a paragraph amasses, and soon a page, and the book is on its way, finding a voice, calling itself into being. A book must start somewhere, and this one starts here. A boy. Shh, listen. That's my book, and it's talking to you. Can you hear it? It's okay if you can't, though. It's not your fault. Things speak all the time, but if your ears aren't attuned, you have to learn to listen. You can start by using your eyes, because eyes are easy. Look at all the things around you. What do you see? A book, obviously, and obviously the book is speaking to you, so try something more challenging. The chair you're sitting on, the pencil in your pocket, the sneaker on your foot. Still can't hear? Then get down on your knees and put your head to the seat, or take off your shoe and hold it to your ear. No, wait. If there's people around, they'll think you're mad, so try it with the pencil first. Pencils have stories inside them, and they're safe as long as you don't stick the point in your ear. Just hold it next to your head and listen. Can you hear the wood whisper, the ghost of the pine, the mutter of lead? So I think I'll stop there just because I would love to, I just want to jump in and talk to Amy.
Thank you so much, Ruth, yeah. And you did beautifully.
Oh, thanks. I wish we were in person and talk and, you know, able to see everybody. But anyway, this is pretty great too.
I know. I wish we were too, but it's nice to be able to, you know, make it work in this.
Yeah, way. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm so delighted to be here to talk to you about this wonderful book. And I just felt so connected to so many of your themes and ideas. So it's really, I'm just pouring over with questions and we'll just see what we can fit in the time and also open it up for audience questions at the end. But I guess where I would want to start is kind of what you were saying about the voices of the book and how they came to you and, mm-hmm. and how you first encountered Benny, because there's such a way that your characters are so deeply inhabited. And I was, you know, looking at comments on your work and how people will talk about the compassion in it. But I feel there's, of course, this deep compassion, but I think it comes from just a deep seeing of mm-hmm. a variety of characters and that you allow them such dimensionality and that becomes compassion, really. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered if you could start by just talking about how you inhabit first Benny, but mm-hmm. but your characters in general.
You know, it's so interesting because I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what novels, that's what fiction does, right? And especially novels because they're long, right? And you can, you know, you really have to get to know the character very, very well. And that goes for first the writer, you know, first the writer has to do that. And then the reader does that as well. And I think it is, you know, it's a kind of exercise of compassion, isn't it? It's an exercise of, you know, it's learning to inhabit somebody else's skin, somebody else's, you know, subjectivity, somebody else's mind, right? And you know, as I've written, you know, I mean, I know that when I first start out, I tend to find the protagonists first, right? You know, and I spend a long time, you know, really trying to understand the world from inside their mind, right? But and then I find that very often I have to go back over and over again for some of the secondary characters because they're harder to get to know, you know, and so it takes, I mean, I think that's what, you know, that's what the kind of rewriting process, you know, is all about. It's about, you know, really spending more time with the secondary characters, but the, you know, characters, usually fictional characters, come to me as voices. And, you know, and so, you know, in my last novel, A Tale for the Time Being, you know, I sort of heard the voice of the protagonist, Nao Yasutani, and she just kind of announced herself, you know, hi, my name is Nao, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? You know, and she just kind of announces herself. And the same is true for Benny. Although it was a little bit different with Benny because I started writing Benny in the third person. You know, I started, you know, the book started from the book's perspective, right? So, you know, it was a, you know, a narrative voice that was talking about Benny and about his, you know, his travails. And as I was doing that, suddenly Benny in a first person voice, you know, I voice just interrupted. Right. He just kind of popped in and started complaining about something, right? And, you know, complaining about the narration, you know, complaining about where the book started, you know. And then that's when I realized, oh, right, this is actually this book is a dialogue between Benny and the book itself. Right. And that, so that's exactly what happens. There's, you know, the book speaks and then Benny speaks and, you know, and the book speaks again and Benny speaks again. And so there's this kind of alternating, you know, a dialogue between the two. And that's sort of how that evolved.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many ways that he's hearing so deeply and then speaking so deeply. Like I can imagine that moment where he would sort of pipe in the same way that he'll interrupt even his own speaking with his thoughts. Like there really is a dialogue within himself.
Yeah.
I mean, which is often quite moving to hear what gets said and what we think inside our minds as shown through Benny.
And that's fascinating that you picked that up too, because I actually hadn't picked it up. And now that you've said that, I'm going to pretend that it was intentional. But you're right. I know, it's great, right? No, but it's true because Benny interrupts himself. You know, I mean, he'll be speaking like he just did, right? Yeah. He'll be speaking and then it's like, no, you know, and he'll correct himself. And so that does raise the question about the relationship between Benny and the book, you know. Is the book in Benny's mind, you know? In other words, you know, which comes first, the book or the boy, right? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg, right?
Yeah.
Is Benny creating the book or is the book creating Benny, or are they kind of mutually co-creating each other, you know? So there's this kind of back and forth quality that gets, that gets kind of reiterated in the way that Benny sort of thinks, you know, his own mind works. I'm going to pretend that I did that on purpose. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the joy, part of the joy of writing, right? Is we connect things without realizing they're connected. And
that's right.
And I want to get back to that, him in the book in a little bit, but also just to stay with him a little bit more too. I think one of the things I loved is it feels like he has such access, right? He's having such a hard time. Mm-hmm. But he has this tremendous access to listening to things that might usually not be heard. Like there's this wonderful special spoon to him that he hears humming. There's the sounds that objects make, and he's very attuned to the nature of what an object wants to do. And it's not always wanting to do pleasant things. Objects have different purposes. And I think I was wondering, and of course, there's so many parallels with the role of the writer, but just what do you think about this access that he has and how that influences the way he views the world? It feels like an access that is both sort of torments him, but it's also what makes him special.
You know, it reminds me of you know, your young protagonist Rose in you know, in The Peculiar Sadness of Lemon Cake, because, you know, she also has access to, you know, to the feeling tone of food, Right. Mm-hmm. And also the provenance of food, mm-hmm. where the food comes from. And Benny has the same kind of access to, you know, the supply chain and the manufacturing of, you know, of objects. I think that with Benny, my sense was that the grief of losing his father, you know, he loses his father, you know, in the first, you know, chapter of the book. And the grief of, you know, losing his father and then, you know, the experience of hearing his father's voice kind of opens him up in a way, and he becomes very sensitized and receptive to the world, right? Yeah. And a lot of what he, you know, a lot of what he hears, he doesn't understand. The objects don't necessarily speak in languages that he, you know, that he understands as language. But again, it's a kind of feeling tone that he, that he gets from, you know, from the things around him. Made objects speak differently than, you know, from unmade objects, you know, objects that occur in nature, you know, are going to have a different feeling tone from, you know, a running shoe, you know. So yeah. it's, you know, and that was just, I guess, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, it's hard to know where that idea came from, but I've just always been fascinated with objects. And I know you have been too. It's another area where, you know, where we have a lot of overlap, I think. And the power that objects have, right, in our lives, and the stories that they hold, you know, and I think I became sort of sensitized to that when, after my parents died and I was cleaning out their house, and, you know, there were just so many, you know, so many things there, particularly on my mother's side. You know, she was Japanese. And, you know, there were all of these, you know, objects from Japan that, you know, were completely exotic and unfamiliar to me. I had no idea what they were, but, you know, I knew that they were terribly old and that they were, you know, that they were just imbued with story. Mm-hmm. And I remember just thinking, you know, why can't they speak to me? You know, if only they could speak to me, I would understand more. And then on my dad's side, he was an anthropologist. And so he had objects from all over the world, right? Mm-hmm. Again, objects that had stories in them that I just couldn't access. And so I think that, you know, and then too, of course, you know, all of they belong to my parents, right? So there was a kind of, you know, that emotional attachment too. And Benny certainly feels that. And his mother, Annabelle, feels that as well. She's very attached to the, you know, the clothing, you know, that belonged to her dead husband. Mm, yeah.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, her relationship to objects is such a good, both sort of counterpoint and companion to, we have Benny actually hearing objects expressing, and her maybe just wanting to be close to the objects and kind of unable to bear giving them up. And then we have, is Icon, would that be the right way?
Icon.
We have a character who's talking about, you know, our relationship to objects, but as it's filtered through Zen and kind of thinking about objects as imbued with spirit and meaning. So I guess I just loved how you're looking at these objects through these various characters. Again, it just felt like each one is inhabiting a different perspective. I don't know what my question is in this, except just, I mean, are you trying to put different facets about the objects, or is it just the characters emerge with their own relationship?
I think that's more it. Yeah. I think the characters just emerge with their own relationship to objects. I mean, certainly, you know, with this book, and with the last one too, you know, I was playing pretty obviously, you know, with sort of little bits of Zen philosophy, you know, and in the last book I was playing with Dogen, you know, the 13th century Zen master's, you know, idea about time and about time and being, right? In this book, I was playing with a koan, you know, a kind of riddle or question, which was, you know, do insentient beings speak the Dharma, Right? Doing sentient beings speak the Dharma. And so what that, you know, loosely what that might mean is, you know, our objects and, you know, plants and trees and, you know, things that we normally think of as insentient, right? Pebbles and, you know, roof tiles and whatever, you know, these insentient beings, can they be our teachers? Right. Can they, you know, can they teach us? And I think of course they can, you know, anything, you know, anything and everything can teach us. Right. And so that's kind of what I was playing with, you know, Icon, you know, being, you know, she's a Japanese Buddhist, Zen Buddhist nun who, has sort of almost by mistake written a book that's become a, you know, international bestseller on clutter clearing, right? Yeah. And so yes, it's a kind of nod to, you know, Marie Kondo. But I was also fascinated when Marie Kondo kind of burst onto the scene, because the things that she was teaching were, you know, they were very Japanese. And, you know, she comes from a Shinto tradition, which is an animist, you know, indigenous Japanese religion, and it's an animist tradition. So, you know, so things do have spirits, right? And so, you know, and you have to honor those spirits and, you know, respect them. And so things can spark joy, right? We have that relationship with them. And when we've, you know, when something has served us, you know, like, you know, a pair of socks, you know, a pair of socks that have, you know, kept our feet warm for, you know, years and have worn themselves out in the, you know, in keeping us warm, you know, rather than, you don't want to just toss them, right? You want to kind of just take a moment to hold them and, you know, kind of feel appropriate gratitude and then throw them out, you know? Right. So it's just that little pause in there, I think is what she's, you know, she's kind of teaching. And I just, it thrilled me that it was becoming so, you know, people were recognizing that as being, you know, kind of a nice thing to do.
Yeah. And people seemed very hungry for that.
Yeah.
Allowing depth on something that we view as just a chore. And I think you deepened it further by allowing it to be a way to talk about certain teachings, you know, very meaningful to see woven through the text. But just like as a quick follow-up to the object thing, I know sometimes for myself, I'll think, you know, what is my fascination with objects? And then I'll think, I don't think it's that different from the way that I also love words. And as I'm thinking that, the book is also so much about the way we relate to words and Borges and the Aleph, and that we have a character named the Aleph, and without, like, I feel very protective of spoilers, but just that there is an allowing of objects and words to be so mushed together. And I just, do you feel like words have a kind of dimensionality that way?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think when I'm writing, you know, that's the world that I'm in, you know, is the world of word as object. And, you know, and so, you know, playing with, and I noticed this in your writing too, you know, it's one of the joys of reading, you know, reading your sentences. I mean, they're beautiful. And you're, you know, your word choice is so, you know, it's so clear and intentional and beautiful. And, you know, so it's, yes, it's exactly that. It's word as object. And it's, you know, it's an object that, you know, that you're manipulating on the page as, you know, as a visual thing. Right. But it's also an, you know, it's also like a note of music. Right. And so, you know, it's both on the page and also something that you're, you know, that you're hearing, which is parallel again to Benny's relationship with, you know, objects in the world. He's seeing them, right? Mm-hmm. And he's interacting with them, but he's also hearing them. He's hearing that kind of feeling tone.
Yeah.
And that, you know, so I, kind of moving back and forth between, you know, the oral and the visual there.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
All right, which part do I want to go to next?
I know.
It relates to this, which is something, first maybe we can talk about Annabelle a little bit, because I loved the character of Annabelle. I found her excruciatingly painful to read about. And I think it's because she's so cheerful and she's in so much pain.
Yeah.
Whereas Benny was so mad and it was so much more a part of his awareness of himself that he was struggling. Yeah. And with Annabelle, she's just so hopeful. I don't know. So I guess I wondered if you could talk about her a little bit, because I also love the way you were thinking about women in this book. And there's a moment with Icon where she's looking at the women and they seem hopeful and fatigued.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, that's what we are right now, right? I mean, I'm sorry. We are so hopeful and so fatigued, right?
I mean, we are.
We really are. The pandemic has really pushed us into a new, you know, realm of both, you know, hope and fatigue. I think we're just so hopeful that the end of it is around the corner, and then we keep having our hopes dashed, you know. So I think Annabelle is interesting to me because I actually think that I identify with her the most. Mm-hmm. There's something in you know, not all of me, but she certainly is a big part of me. She represents a kind of big part of me. You know, it's exactly that. It's her, it's how hard she tries, you right. know, and how she just wears herself out trying. Yeah. And I feel like that's, you know, that's something that I've, you know, and I think that many women do, you know, that we, you know, that we really are trying so hard to get it right. You know, she's trying so hard to be a good mother, right? And yet she's just, you know, her heart has been broken. She's lost the love of her life. And, you know, and she's now has this child who is having problems. And she, you know, she just keeps trying. And she, what I think is, I think kind of poignant about Annabelle, and something that I relate to as well, is the way that she keeps seeing the promise in things,
exactly.
right? Like she's just in that sense, just kind of, you know, indefatigable in a way, because I mean, she likes to go to Michael's, the craft store, and, you know, and just kind of wander up and down the aisles, because in all of that material, she senses the potential in it, right? To become something beautiful, right? To become something, you know, something special, and she just wants to help it along somehow, you know. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I have that same relationship to like stationery and to
yes.
pens, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And it's just like I want them all.
Right. They are so right. They are so appealing.
They're so appealing. And paper and pens and any kind of stationery store. I mean, even Staples I can spend, you know, hours in, right? But you know, like Japanese stationery stores, forget about it. It's just
right.
Yeah, right. Incredible. So I have that, I get it. I get that feeling. And you know, and so, you know, I have deep sympathy with yeah. Annabelle, and also with the attachment to things, you know, or, you know, like her attachment to, you know, to her husband Kenji's, you know, flannel shirts yeah, that she just, you know, she couldn't get rid of them. And she, you know, she didn't feel right about saving them either, you know, but then she thinks, I'll make a memory quilt. Right. I mean, what a beautiful idea. Right. And yet, of course, because she's so overwhelmed, she never quite gets around to it. And that's something else I identify with, is this idea of, you know, having lots of projects that I never get around to.
I think so many people can identify with that. Right. And I think ultimately I found her painful for exactly that reason that I identified with her as well.
Yeah.
And could see in myself that sort of cheerfulness at moments that doesn't match, you know, in this way that I would, but yeah. And so I felt there were some things, and this was true with Benny too, that you were allowing both of them sort of, it just didn't feel hurried in terms of their mm-hmm. own struggle. It felt like there was time for them to be on a sort of genuine track of mm-hmm. what was happening without it, you know.
Good. Yeah, good. I mean, in this book, I think in particular, I really wanted, you know, I did feel committed to, you know, allowing the characters to just follow their trajectories. You know, I I have a kind of a, you know, uneasy relationship to planning and to plotting, right? And I think it's partly because, you know, I'm not bored exactly, but I want to write beyond the limitations of my own mind.
Right.
I get into kind of mental ruts. So then how do you sort of push yourself outside those mental ruts and see the world in a way that is strange, even to me, right? I mean, particularly to me. And so what I like to try to do is introduce, you know, sort of serendipity into the process, you know, in kind of introduce random factors into the process and see what happens. And so in this book, I had a kind of a game that I was playing because it's a book about objects, right? And rather than me deciding, you know, oh, I think I'll put this object in, right? Because that's once again me being kind of, you know, trapped in my own ideas, right? What I did instead was when somebody gave me an object, I would just put it in the book and see what happened, right? And so, I mean, I'll show you since we can do this, it's show and tell.
Oh, it's so
but my,
fun.
Yeah, so my friend and former editor went, Carol DeSanti, went on a vacation. And, you know, I love sea turtles, right? Mm. So she brought me this.
There it is.
Right?
I remember that.
Right? Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And so it's a, you know, it's a snow globe with sea turtles. And so I gave it to Annabelle. I mean, I thought this is great, you know? And so I gave it to Annabelle. And then the next thing I know, Annabelle is like on eBay collecting, you know, collecting snow globes, right? And then the snow globe image kind of proliferated, like, the Aleph starts making catastrophic snow globes of like Hurricane Katrina and 9/11 and, you know, these kind of catastrophe, disaster, snow globes. And then it became kind of a metaphor for Benny, who's kind of trapped in, you know, his own world and his mother on the outside kind of looking in, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, just introducing kind of random elements, you know, at one point I went to a Chinese restaurant and got a, you probably can't read it. Oh, there it is. It says, "The world is a beautiful book for those who read it."
Wow. Right?
And it was just like, oh, that's pretty perfect. So I started, So I, you know, the whole idea of like little slips of paper with messages on them and stuff, you know, sort of came from this, right?
So that, this way that you're slipping things from your life into the book, the same way certain characters are slipping things in. It reminds me too, there was what it was for Miranda July, but there was a point where she created some of the objects that, and she put them for sale on a website from her story. So she kind of did the opposite where she extracted the objects. She sort of reached in and made them three-dimensional and then sold them so that you could have like a receipt from the story. It was just so, it was such a wonderful performance art because it was,
that's great.
It was so great.
Maybe I'll start selling my snow globes then.
I'm sure you would find an eager buyer. But that's so great. So you're looking for something outside yourself at that point to put into the flow of the book.
Yeah. And to give to the characters so that the characters can then relate to them and then surprise me. Right. Yeah. And it just moves the story sort of a little bit outside my control always, you know, which is kind of makes it a lot more exciting, you know, the writing process more exciting.
Would you have any like rules around it? Like you have to put every object you get or, I mean, was it just whatever spoke to you?
Whatever spoke to me, whatever sparked joy.
Okay, nice. Went in the book. I love it.
Went in the book. Yeah.
It goes in the book like that. All right, I want to squeeze in a couple more before
to
the audience. But one is, this is sort of relating to some of the Zen themes in the book, but I'm interested, I'm trying to think of how can I articulate this effectively, but there's this feeling that, you know, and it's commented upon that the book is kind of narrating Benny's life. And yet I think of, There's Glenn David Gold has a memoir, I Will Be Complete, where he talks about part of the writer's experience is like trying to undo how much we may narrate our own lives. Like the writer is seeing the world and sort of getting ready to get it on the page. And yet Benny has a kind of mixed relationship with this book, talking to him about himself. He feels intruded upon, and he also feels perhaps kind of contained. So I guess I was wondering, as a kind of, like, when is language helpful help to Benny, and when might it be a barrier from experience, the kind of, you know, what we might try to move closer to, moving language aside so we can, does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense in a Zen context in particular, right? Yeah. Where language is often looked at as a kind of, you know, impediment to experiencing things as they are, you know, the quiddity of, you know, of things of the world, right? Another word that is just such a beautiful word, you know, yeah. Like that's a word that you really want to hold on to, right?
Yeah. Stick yeah. it in the book.
Like it just, yeah, like, yeah. but, you know, just this idea of like the, you know, language somehow interfering with our, you know, our experience, direct experience of the world, right? But, you know, this is where Dogen, you know, our old pal Dogen Zenji has a very different, that's the traditional Zen, you know, idea is that, you know, that language, you know, is like the finger pointing at the moon. It's not the, you know, experience of the moon, right?
Right. But
Dogen has a, you know, has a different, slightly different take on it, which is that, you know, that language is its own experience, right? And that, you know, our experience of language is a very human, it is its own experience, right? And that it's like the air we breathe as humans. It's like the water that we swim in, right? You know, if you're a fish, right? You know, so it's our natural environment, and you can't, you know, you can't sort of separate them. You know, they're not two different things. They're not separate. You know, it's all included, right, in the experience of being, you know, a human, right?
Yeah.
And so I've always appreciated that about Dogen. Of course, the thing is that Dogen is a writer, you know,
right.
So he's suspect, right? I mean, it could just be, you know, it could just be kind of an elaborate justification, you know?
Exactly. Well, and then just in this last, I had to ask you because, so I'd mentioned my husband is Buddhist and has been studying Zen this past year, just like coincidentally sort of turning towards Zen specifically. And he's been quoting Norman Fisher to me
all year.
He's been walking around just talking about Norman Fisher and how incredible Norman Fisher is. And then I get to the acknowledgments of your book and it's like, you know, one of the first.
Norman Fisher.
Yeah. So I just wondered if you could spend a minute just talking about Norman Fisher first.
Yeah, of course. No, Norman is my Zen teacher, and he's the founder of the Everyday Zen Foundation. And, you know, I've been sitting and studying and practicing with Norman since, I think, 2000, maybe. And, you know, again, you know, it's interesting because, you know, my grandparents on my Japanese side were Zen Buddhists, right? And so, you know, that was the first, you know, sort of impression I had of Buddhism was when I was 3 years old and saw my grandfather sitting Zazen, you know, sitting in meditation. And, you know, and then I was always interested in meditation and I kind of, you know, played around with it. And then years later, you know, when I was, you know, well, quite later, you know, in 2000, I met Norman and, you know, and that's when I sort of came back to Zen. And I think that, you know, of course, Norman is also a writer. He's a poet and, you know, a beautiful essayist. And I think there was something there that I recognized and, you know, just felt again, a kind of, you know, just kinship with. And what's wonderful about Norman is the way that he really does have a, you know, he has such a wide, you know, broad, but also very deep, you know, understanding not just of Buddhism, but of Judaism and, you know, of Western philosophy. And, you know, he folds all of that in. And, you know, so, you know, I think he's Yeah, he's just a remarkable teacher, and he's a remarkable writer. And, you know, I really recommend his books. And, you know, I think that most of the kind of interesting ideas that I have, I probably stole from Norman. You know, he probably was giving a Dharma talk and I heard something and it was like, you know, and then that plant kind of planted the seed. And then, you know, 10 years later, it kind of, you know, a novel grows from there, you know? Yeah. So I really think that, you know, Norman has been the source of, you know, he claims that he doesn't recognize, you know, his teachings in, you know, in my books, but then I can point out, you know, I can point to things and say that you said that, and he claims he doesn't remember. So maybe it's just that he's kind of, you know, right. Maybe it's just like, no, I don't want to, you know.
It seems likely that he might not, he would say that he's, the ideas are not his, you know, they're
right. That's right. That's right. So, that's right. That's right. That's right.
All right. So I got to turn to the audience.
Okay.
But how about Liesl Friedrich was wondering if you would explain the title.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, the title is from a, thank you for asking, Liesl. Yeah, the title is from a very, you know, central, important Zen sutra called the Heart Sutra. And the line is, you know, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And so it's, you know, the word emptiness is a kind of abstract and difficult word to kind of understand, you know, in English. But the way I like to think about it is, you know, if you imagine emptiness as, you know, a kind of vast ocean, right? And it's so vast that you can't see the shore. All you can see is ocean. And then, you know, the wind starts to work on the ocean, and the, you know, the planet starts to, you know, turns, and the tides, you know, work on the water, and from that big vast ocean a little wave starts to emerge, right? And the wave kind of comes up and it pops its little head up, and it, you know, has this little white cap, and it looks around, and it's you know, it's like, wow, you know, look at me, you know, I'm really something, I'm a wave, you know, I have form, right? And all of this, you know, out of all of this emptiness, like, I'm really something. In other words, it has this idea of itself as a self, right? And then, of course, you know, again, the, you know, tides shift and the planet turns, and suddenly the little wave starts to, you know, drop down again. And it's like, oh, you know, help, you know, and it disappears back into the planet. And so it's that relationship between form, you know, and emptiness. And so what it's really referring to is this idea, again, of, you know, central Buddhist idea of impermanence, right? And also a kind of radical interbeing or interconnectedness, because you cannot separate the wave from the ocean or the ocean from the wave. You know, they're part of the same thing. And yet when the wave is a wave, it has form. And when it, you know, falls back into the ocean, it you know, it's empty, right? So it's that, that's the relationship. And I think that in this book, I'm really thinking about everything like that. I'm thinking about objects like that. I'm thinking about language like that, about books, certainly like that, you know, kind of emerging from, you know, emptiness into something that has form.
It's beautiful. So I'm going to combine a couple questions here because we didn't get a chance to talk so much about this. But MJ Plack says, it seems that you, Ruth Ozeki, feel that concepts like mental illness or pathology are unhelpful labels, and that medication interrupts the potential growth and learning inherent in this difference. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. And maybe related, Carmen Hernandez asks, in the acknowledgments you mentioned the Hearing Voices Network.
Yeah, good.
Could you talk about their influence?
Sure. The Hearing Voices Network is a wonderful organization, you know, that supports, and it's a, you know, grassroots organization that supports people who hear voices, but also see things that are unshared, you know, you know, sort of have unshared experience, you know, unshared experiences. And, you know, it's not that I guess my you know, one of the things I was really thinking about when I was writing this book is, you know, I've had the experience of hearing voices that are outside my head, right? That no one else can hear. And when my dad died, very much like Benny, right? For about a year or so after that, I would hear him, you know, sort of clear his throat and say my name. And it was always kind of here, you know, behind me. And, you know, every time that happened, you know, it was a kind of, you know, I'd be doing something random, like washing the dishes, and I'd hear this and I'd turn around, right? And he wouldn't be there. And I'd remember, oh, right, he died. And there'd be this kind of, you know, hit of grief and that feeling of loss again, right? And in my case, that, you know, that experience sort of faded out after about a year. So I know what that feels like to hear something that no one else can hear, right? And that is very real, right? And so then I was, you know, I was also thinking about how, you know, as I said before, you know, characters come to me as voices, right? But these are voices that, you know, are sort of, I hear with my mind kind of inside my head, right? And so that's a different kind of hearing, right? It's a kind of more internal hearing, not this kind of external hearing. And then I was thinking about, you know, the sort of neurotic, you know, voices of the inner critic, which I certainly, and I'm sure you do too, you know, most people and certainly most writers and, you know, artists struggle with all the time. And those are the voices that are telling me that, you know, what I'm doing, like, you know, whatever it is that I'm writing is like really sucks. And, you know, I should just give up. I should, you know, nobody's going to be interested in this and I should just get a real job. Right. And so there's this kind of spectrum of voices, you know, and some of the voices like the, you know, the creative, the, you know, the creative voices, are sort of celebrated by our culture. Right. Where, and the neurotic voices are, you know, are, well, we, you know, we all share them and we all have them and they're kind of okay. But then the other voices that, you know, that we hear, you know, outside our heads, if you, you know, if you talk about that to a psychiatrist, you know, chances are you will be diagnosed with something, you know, some sort of schizoaffective disorder or schizophrenia or some sort of, you know, psychosis. And so I guess my, you know, and sometimes those voices are, you know, are very troublesome. But sometimes a lot of people hear voices and it's, you know, it's not a problem. So I guess the, you know, the question that was in my mind as I was writing this was, you know, who gets to decide what's pathological and what's not pathological, you know, and why is it that, you know, that in our culture, you know, we have this idea of normal, right? And it's very narrow. And, you know, so why is it that we can't, you know, but it's a social construct. We've decided that this is normal, right? It's not, you know, it's not real. It's something that we have invented. And so if that's the case, why can't we expand that, you know, concept of normal to be, you know, wider and more inclusive, right? And why, you know, why can't we question this idea of like, who gets to decide, you know, what's pathological and what's not? You know, it, ironically, you know, Freud and, you know, Jung were both, you know, the quote fathers of, you know, psychology, both talked about hearing voices, you know, they both heard voices. You know, Mahatma Gandhi heard voices, Joan of Arc heard voices, right? There are many people who hear voices, you know, who are not bothered by them. And so, you know, is this necessarily a, you know, a pathology? That's, it's just asking that question.
So Audrey Murawski was saying, have you been exposed to Shinto thought and the kami or spirits? Aren't kami also founded in sentient creatures like pebbles?
Yeah, well, you know, coming from, you know, a Japanese background, yes, I certainly have. And, you know, and that's something that's always interested me too, you know. And I think it's, you know, it's something that, you know, this idea of animated objects is something that, you know, has really informed Japanese art. And I think you can see it in, you know, in Japanese anime, right? I mean, it's, you know, things have life, right? They have vitality, they can speak, they can move, they can, you know, they can communicate. You know, and so yes, absolutely. You know, I think it's kind of a, you know, it's a very, it can be a very beautiful thing. And it can be kind of scary too. You know, I mean, it's why in Japan, you know, if you have a broken needle, right, you don't just throw it away, right? You wait. And once a year at the, you know, at the shrine, they'll have a, you know,
a special day where you can bring your broken needle to the shrine, and on the altar is a block of tofu, right? And you take your broken needle and you put it into the tofu so that your needle can have a soft resting space, you know, resting place. And, you know, it's a way of showing gratitude to the needle. And then, you know, there's a memorial service and, you know, it's, you know, you can express your gratitude. But it's also a little bit of insurance, you know, because that needle is sharp, you know, and right. If you don't respect it, it can hurt you. Right. So it's a kind of.
Bats want to hit.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah. A couple of people thought, one of my favorite parts of the book was the writer in the library who seems to be some version of you, or someone said about, called it a cameo.
Right. That's my like Alfred Hitchcock moment.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that character.
Yeah. She's a typing lady, right? And she sits up in the, you know, in this library. It's a vast library and there's many levels to the library. And at the very top, there's a little cluster, a little nook, you know, where there's a cluster of desks, of carrels, right? And it's where Benny likes to hang out. And in one of the adjacent carrels is this woman, you know, this kind of vaguely Asian looking woman with, you know, with dark, you know, rim glasses. And she always has her laptop there and she just kind of observes things and types. She's always typing, you know, and Benny, you know, Benny has various interactions with her. You know, the Annabelle also has some interactions with her. But mostly her, you know, her role is just sort of observing and typing and kind of not interfering. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's kind of what I feel like my role is to, is to just type as fast as I can and not interfere too much.
Yeah. I love that. I think we have time for a couple more, but we're going to stop right at 6 because Ruth has.
Oh, it's 6 there, right? It's almost 9 for me.
Right, exactly. Barb asked, do you have a favorite object or word that speaks to you? And if so, could you tell us about it?
Well, my recent favorite word is quiddity, as I, you know, managed to slip that into the conversation already. It changes all the time, but that's the one today. And favorite object? Well, I have lots of favorite objects. I mean, so it's kind of unfair, but this is certainly one of them. It's, you can see it. I'm wearing it around my neck. It is a brass Japanese fountain pen. Can you see it?
Yeah.
And it's just become a kind of talisman, you know. And it's great because I always have something to write with. But it's also, there's just something about it that is just incredibly satisfying to me. It got kind of burnished, you know, the brass kind of gets burnished. And anyway, this is my favorite, one of my favorite objects. And this is another one.
Yeah.
This is you can see this, right? This is the lunar globe.
It's lunar.
It's the lunar globe that appears in the book. There's a lunar globe in the book and this is it right here.
Yeah, right.
And I love it. It's got all of the craters marked on it, right?
And they pick the craters, right? They pick the different
ones.
That's
right. Yeah.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
It's beautiful. Yeah. And the craters are so beautifully named. The Sea of Cold, the Sea of Rains. You know,
yeah, when the scientists are also poets.
Yeah. The Sea of Crises.
Yeah.
You know, like, who are these people who named this?
So as our final question relating, because this book has so many key scenes in a library, and because of what you mentioned before we went live, Tina Lerno asks, was that library based on one you've been to?
I wanted to create a space that was, I wanted to create a book that was kind of, you know, reality adjacent, you know, I didn't want to have a recognizable city and a recognizable library in a recognizable city. So basically what I did was I took little bits from libraries along the West Coast. starting in Vancouver and ending in LA. So there's, you know, there's a little bit of the LA Public Library, there's a little bit of the San Francisco Public Library, there's a little bit of, there's, you know, the Rem Koolhaas Library in Seattle that features. But the library that I think is kind of most represented is the Vancouver Public Library, because indeed the Vancouver Public Library was the site of the last public bindery. And so I have visited that bindery when they were closing it down, and there was a huge outcry amongst library patrons who didn't want to see that bindery closed. The reason it was being closed, of course, is because everything was going online, and they no longer had to make, you know, they no longer had to bind periodicals, right? Collections of periodicals, everything was available online. But there was just this idea of the bindery, you know, of the book as object kind of reaching the end of its life somehow with the closing of that bindery, that people were really, you know, objecting to. And the other thing was that the Vancouver Public Library, now this, I think that they were pulling my leg, but they, you know, insisted that the sub-basement was haunted, you know, and they told me that, you know, the night security guards used to hear calypso music coming from the sub basement. So I had to put that in.
Of course.
Again, just more, you know, more things. You
exactly.
Know, right.
Well, it's like putting the crows, right?
That's
like
right.
The crows bringing things.
That's right. That's right. That's right. The crows bringing trinkets. That's right.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, thank you, Ruth Ozeki, so much. It's just been such a thrill to hear you and get a chance to talk to you. I'm sorry I couldn't get to all the questions. They were all.
Well, we'll just have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, exactly. And the audience ones too were great. Anyway, and thank you to each of you in the audience for joining us into the Library Foundation. What a pleasure to get some time to hear.
Great. Thank you so much, Amy. And thanks everybody for coming.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.